There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The Michael Reid Show Podcast. Tune in weekdays from 9 on LMFM. To contact us, email now, michael@lmfm.ie.
Wednesday morning, the 4th of January. Good morning. With much debate and discussion from now till 11 a.m, this is Michael Reid on LMFM. The Minister for Health was visiting hospitals yesterday to see for himself firsthand the extent of overcrowding that's being felt in emergency departments right across the country.
We're here at Beaumont Hospital this evening. I was in St Vincent's earlier on today, and I met with the senior HSE management team earlier today to make sure that everything that can be done is being done. And we're aware that there is a very significant pressure on patients and on our healthcare professionals across the hospital system, across the HSEs. In some hospitals, it's more severe than in others.
Locally, hospitals are under huge pressure, with 33 people admitted to hospital in Drogheda yesterday who were told there was no bed available in the Lourdes to actually admit them to. In Navan, 10 patients were admitted by doctors, but there were no beds available for them in Our Lady's.
Government's focus is making sure that all measures that can be taken are taking. So what does this include? It includes the use of all available private capacity. That's private hospitals, private diagnostics, home care supports, GPs, who I want to acknowledge have really stepped up. They've agreed to do additional work this week and into the coming week.
Well, with almost 1,000 people on trolleys yesterday, everything that can be done must be done.
We're looking at staffing. We're very keen to see senior decision makers on site, particularly when patients need them, be it late at night, be it at the weekends, where that is needed, and various other measures.
The objective to solving this crisis is simple in one way, and that is if a patient is admitted to hospital, they go to a ward and they get treated in a hospital bed.
To make sure that there are options for patients once they're admitted to get up into a ward bed. To do that, obviously, we need to make sure that all discharge options are available. One of the things the HSE has been bringing online is more and more options for the hospitals to discharge to community nursing units, to community beds, as well as home support beds.
Stephen Donnelly under pressure. Cabinet meets today and the minister will update government on this crisis.
I'll be meeting with the HSE senior team again on Friday, and obviously we'll be managing this on a daily basis.
That's the Minister for Health, Stephen Donnelly, speaking to reporters last night. Now, we may hear more of that press conference later in the programme today, but let's speak now to AIM2 leader and founder, Padraig Tobin, TD for Mead West, who's on the line. And a very good morning to you, and thank you indeed for joining us on the programme this morning. There's no doubt a lot is being done, and everything that can be done is being done to try and stop this crisis, but it's a crisis of the government's own making, you would contend.
Yeah, it's an incredible situation. In many ways, when you listen to the government, you feel that the government are nearly blaming people for getting sick, and that's causing the crisis within the health service. The cause of the crisis in the health service is the lack of capacity. We have a health system that spills for 3.5 million people, and not the 5.5 million people now that live in the state. We have a health service that went through 10 years just after the crash of having its services cut, which has had a massive significant reduction in the level of capacity just in the last while. And we have a health service that have gone through closures. There's 8 A&Es have been closed in this state in the last 15 years. Now, if you close 8 A&Es then in 15 years and then find that all the A&Es are rammed, that they're jammed, that they're stuffed, you know, logic will tell you maybe you closed too many A&Es, and that's a part of the problem in relation to this. And it was really interesting. Yesterday, Professor Declan Lyons, who's a consultant physician and geriatrician in Limerick Hospital, who himself, I believe, was a clinical director of Limerick University Hospital, he stated on live radio, which is what we have been stating for a long period of time, he stated in 2009 the closure of the A&Es in Ennis, Nina and St. John's Hospital were wrong, and they have, in part, significantly caused the pressure, the chaos that's happening in Limerick University Hospital at the moment. And the fact that senior clinicians are waking up to this 10 years later, but still the HSC is involved in the process of closing A&Es, it's still absolutely mind-bending from the perspective of a citizen in this country.
It's a little bit more than 10 years, though, isn't it?
It's been 15 years since the likes of Nina and Ennis and St. John's Hospital and even Monaghan and Dundalk, those A&Es lost their A&Es. And as a result, that's put the pressure on the rest of the section. And that's leading to, and it's very important to say this, that's leading to the overcrowding. It's leading to patients being crammed on trolleys side by side in A&Es. It's leading to, you know, not enough space for doctors and nurses to carry out, you know, the delivery of diagnostics and treatment on those patients. It allows for the cross, you know, fertilization of contagious illness in those small spaces. And it's leading to deaths. There's about 360 people who are dying every year in this state due to hospital overcrowding. And even like, you know, I've been looking at the figures and I've got a parliamentary question response back on this. There was 105,000 adverse incidents last year in the healthcare system. So that is situations where patients in the healthcare system had damage done to them, not by accident, in the healthcare system. And that's leading to, in some cases, death, in some cases, people being disabled, etc. And we have a situation where the state has paid out 2 billion euros in compensation for those adverse incidents in a short period of time. That money should have gone into the creation of new staff, new capacity, etc., the delivery of proper health services, rather than see this damage being done, being compensated for it in the end.
Right, well, there's nearly 1,000 people on trolleys yesterday, and what that means is that those people need to be treated in hospital. They're so sick that they should be in hospital, being cared for on a ward in a hospital bed. They've been admitted to the hospital by the doctors, but there just isn't a bed available for them on a ward in the hospital that they're attending. And there's almost 1,000 people in that situation. Can I quote a government minister on this who said that the bottom line is that no one, particularly no older person, should sleep overnight on a trolley in a corridor. The same minister said that every resource would be prioritised and every action needed would be taken to improve care for patients at A&E. People who need to be admitted will have beds, not trolleys, and the basics for human dignity. That will be put in place in the coming months, this minister said, because anything less than that would be unacceptable to the public, not acceptable to the minister and not acceptable to the HSE. Now, that's a statement from the Minister for Health, who declared a national emergency in hospitals, emergency departments, almost 20 years ago. In 2006, Mary Harney made those comments when she was the Minister for Health. She made those comments because of the public outcry when there was 495 people on trolleys. And that compares to double that figure yesterday, almost 1,000 on trolleys. It's an incredible situation.
Yeah, so there's a couple of points to that. I believe there's a duplicity inherent in the government's approach to this. So yes, the likes of Mary Harney say exactly what James Riley, exactly what Stephen Donnelly say. The language is nearly exactly the same over the period of those 20 years. Yet they carry out policies which lead directly to this. situation. So they're saying one thing to ameliorate the anger that's in society, but they're still following exactly the same policy platform, which is causing the damage. The second thing is, in relation to Minister Donnelly saying that they're going to get every single resource in place to make sure these problems don't happen. Well, the situation in Limerick was particularly kicked off because Shannon Dock, which is its out-of-hours doctor on call service there, literally was grinding to a halt, nearly fell apart just before Christmas. It couldn't take patients. And as a result, patients then were sent into A&E to be dealt with. And that's, Shannon Dock is not on its own in relation to this. In Meath and in Louth at the moment, there are many evenings and nights where there's no doctor on call, where people have to travel 80, 90 kilometres to a doctor on call. So those people are going to go into A&E's instead. Step down. Right now there's about 600 patients in hospitals in Ireland that are clinically discharged. That means the doctor has said, we can do no more for you. You should be either at home or in some other part of the health service to get treatment that can be delivered there. And yet the home care packages are not in place. The pathways into other health service elements are not in place. So those clinically discharged patients can't leave those hospitals. Mm. Now, that's about 600. If you take the 600 away from the 900...
And that's because there isn't a home care service available for them or there isn't a nursing home space available for them or a step-down bed available for them, but they shouldn't be in hospital.
That's it. And that's two-thirds of the people who are on trolleys.
That's not acceptable. That's not...
Absolutely.
It's not. It's not. It's not acceptable. And 20 years ago wasn't acceptable. Let me just run over that line that the minister in 2006 said, not acceptable to the public, not acceptable to the minister, and not acceptable to the HSE. In 2007, I take it, it wasn't acceptable to the public, acceptable to the unacceptable to the minister, and unacceptable to the HSE. In 2008, I imagine it was the same. And I imagine that come January of 2024, it won't be something that is acceptable to the public. It won't be acceptable to the minister and it won't be acceptable to the HSE. But will it be the situation, acceptable or otherwise?
It will be the situation. And I'll tell you why. Because we have witnessed, especially in this region, over the last number of months, a titanic battle between the HSE and the minister, where the HSE is simply ruling the roost and doing what it wants to do, and while at the same time the minister is, you know, has his hands tied and is finding it very difficult to push back and stop the HSE. You know, an incredible issue that, you know, I was reading yesterday, researching about this yesterday, was that, you know, we know there's a major crisis in GP access. And again, lack of GP access leads to overcrowding in A&Es, because if you can't get on a GP list, number one, you have to go to an A&E. And if you can't get an appointment with a GP for 2 weeks, you have to go to the A&E. The HSE does not know how many people are waiting for to get onto a GP list in this country. They don't analyse, they don't, you know, record or identify the amount of people who can't get a GP appointment or how long they're waiting. But that's the key building block of this. The GP is the first door into the health service in this country. And if the first door is blocked, well, then people are pushed into the A&E. So how do you fix the A&E overcrowding if you can't get the GP stuff right? And secondly, the minister mentions, you know, that all private health service capacity will be put into place. Right now, there's no centralised system for private healthcare capacity to be utilised within the public health system. So it's done on an ad hoc basis, here and there. But there's no, you know, group of people, two or three or four people, who are saying, okay, here's capacity, here's an A&E that's a private A&E, but it shuts in the weekend or it closes at 8 o'clock in the evening, let's get that ramped up overnight, etc. And if the minister meant business, he would be pushing for that as well.
Okay, well, the government might argue otherwise, but governments have been arguing otherwise for 20 years, and this problem dates back to before Mary Harney declared the problems in emergency departments a national emergency that had to be tackled as a priority. And 20 years on, if you like, the problem is twice as bad. But over the years, we've heard the government say that they'll respond by dealing with those discharge problems, making more nursing home beds available, more home care areas available, step-down beds and so on. We've heard about the GPs, primary care centres and all that sort of thing. More beds will be brought online in hospitals, more staff, consultants, consultants will work different hours, new contracts and all of that sort of thing. But here we are 20 years on and the problem is twice as bad. Maybe you bear with me for a moment and we'll hear a little bit more from the minister, because the government will say that they've invested an awful lot, and in fairness they have invested an awful lot into the health service. But why does the problem continue?
People have asked why the pressures that we're seeing now. We know that there has been an unprecedented level of investment by government since COVID arrived. We have about 950 extra hospital beds, a lot of extra ICU capacity, hundreds of extra community beds, over 16,000 more healthcare professionals working within the HSE. So we've seen a permanent expansion in our public health system over the last few years that is unprecedented. And so people are asking, well, then why are we still seeing these pressures? What the HSC are telling me and what the treating clinicians in the emergency departments are saying is they're still dealing with COVID, obviously. There's still a lot of people coming into hospital with COVID. There have to be separate pathways for COVID patients. There are infection prevention and control measures around COVID patients that mean that more beds or less beds rather become available when COVID patients are coming in. We've had a big wave of RSV. The latest figures show that that is falling, and we want to see that continue to fall. But what I'm hearing this week, what I was hearing last week, and what I'm hearing here today and in Vincent's today, is that the flu wave is very severe. It's hit earlier than it normally would. And so we have this perfect storm of RSV, the flu, and COVID, obviously, as well as all of the normal pressures. And that really that has absorbed the significant additional capacity that has been put into the system. Right,
that's the Minister, Stephen Donnelly, explaining why there's a problem this year. And in fairness to the Minister, Patrick Tobin, it's not a uniquely Irish problem. This perfect storm that he talks about is being felt across Europe, isn't it? The combination of flu, RSV and COVID.
Like, again, what we have is the Minister saying the reason why hospitals are full is because people keep getting sick. If people would just have a little bit of cop on and stop getting sick, there'd be no problem with the minister's hospital system. What kind of nonsense is that? The idea that the capacity crisis in the hospital system is due to the fact that pesky people keep getting sick is absolutely wrong. The reason there's a capacity problem in the hospital system is because the government have gutted it. Now, I listened to the minister saying that we've had an unprecedented increase in the number of hospital beds, ICU beds, etc. Now, he takes a baseline of at the bottom of just after the crash. So when the government literally had gutted the health service, it did go down to a really low level. And yes, they have increased the number of beds, etc. since then, marginally. But in 2008, before the crash, there were 21,000 hospital beds in this state. Now, today, there are 14,412. So when the minister and you, when people listen to the minister or the Taoiseach say we've invested massively, figures are up, they're only talking about figures are up from the very bottom of the trough after the crash.
Just repeat those figures again, if you would.
So in 2008, there were 21,000 hospital beds. In 2020, there were 14,412 hospital beds in the state. And that's the population is easily increased by over 200,000 people in that period of
time. So that's 7,000 fewer beds.
7,000 fewer beds than there was just before the crash. When the minister's quoting that there's been an increase in hospital beds, and they do this all of the time, and it's really sneaky, they're quoting from about 2014 when literally we were on the floor in capacity in this state after all the cutbacks, after we had the troika in this country. So it is deeply disingenuous to say that we have an increased strength health service. We simply don't. We don't have enough. And the other point I will say to you as well, there is a lot of money going into the health service, for absolute sure. But that money has not been focused on frontline delivery of diagnostics, engagements, consultations, operations or treatments. That money is getting lost in layers of management. And we believe what needs to happen is hospitals and the health service should get paid on the number of engagements they have with patients. Every time there's an operation, every time there's a consultation, every time there's a diagnosis or a treatment, well, then you can get paid on that basis. In the same way that a small business only gets paid on the basis of value it brings to actual customers, the HSE should only get paid on the basis of value it brings to actual patients. Because what happens is in this country is we see in hospitals will actually close operations down for 3 or 4 months over the winter. And that means that you know, lists are getting longer, people are waiting longer, but the hospital is still getting paid the same. The money is still coming through the same. But if you turned around to the hospital and said, no, 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 you're only getting paid if you actually continue delivering in those operations, then you would see the reduction in the level of people on the waiting list. There are 850,000 people in this country currently waiting for a operation or a consultation in hospitals, and that's an incredible situation.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt about it. It's a completely incredulous situation because we're talking about a situation where the problem has doubled over 20 years or thereabouts when we were told it was a national emergency and it had to be tackled as a matter of priority. And I'm sure you'll agree that people shouldn't go to the emergency department or to hospital if they don't need to. But about 1,000 people went yesterday and they needed to be in hospital because the doctor said they needed hospital care, but there just wasn't enough room in the hospitals for them.
Absolutely. And what's going to happen with many of those people is their diagnosis will be delayed because they're waiting so long to get in, maybe 12, 14, 16 hours to get treatment. Their actual treatment will be delayed as well. And there is a direct correlation between delayed diagnosis, delayed treatment, and the outcomes for patients. And studies have been done in Britain in relation to this, and they have shown that there's an increase in mortality, in death, as a result of people waiting significant times to get seen and treated in a...
The consequences of a stroke going untreated is pretty unbelievable if somebody's in the hospital waiting.
Absolutely,
for
and we saw that that very, very sad case where that young woman in Limerick Hospital waited, I think, 16 hours to be seen, and she lost her life. So this is a life and death situation. This is a threat to health. It's a threat to people's lives, and it should be treated as such.
All right.
And unless the government changed tack on this, now, and one other point I just want to say on this. The government, you know, they tell you about what they've invested, etc. When it comes to the election, Fine Gael will fight that election on what kind of taxes it can reduce for people. So in this country, we have an argument every election about delivering European health services, but the government say they'll do it on US taxes. That is the deep inherent lie at the bottom of this problem. You can't do both. You can't have a US tax system and a European health service.
Boston or Berlin, it's up to people to choose, is an argument that's been going on for 20 years for that matter. We leave it there for the moment, though. Thank you indeed for joining us on the programme today. That's the leader and founder of the AIM2 party, Patrick O'Bean, who's a TD for Meath West.
Michael Reed on LMFM.
Now, Pope Benedict will be buried tomorrow. Let's look back on his leadership of the Roman Catholic Church with Brendan Butler, a member of We Are Church Ireland. Good morning to you, Brendan, and thanks for joining us on the programme this morning.
And happy new year to you and our listeners.
And a very happy new year to you. And thanks for joining us once again on the programme. It's a while since we last spoke. Indeed, I think we spoke some time ago when Benedict became Pope, and he made history, of course, for resigning as Pope in 2013. But his tenure was certainly one that will be remembered, and not always for reasons that would be considered to be complimentary.
Yes, that's correct, I think, Michael. Without being too critical of the person, his policies after the Second Vatican Council, you know, in 1962-1965, Pope John the 23rd, his great cry at that stage was aggiornamento, that is, bringing the church up to date and making it relevant to people. And then what happened then, John Paul II was elected, and within 3 years he appointed the future Pope Benedict as his most powerful secretary in charge of the doctrine of the faith. And over 32 years, they dominated the church. And their motto was restoration, that is, to bring the church back to where it was before the Second Vatican Council. So there was a great conflict going on over all these years. And if anyone sort of said anything out of place, they were either silenced or excommunicated. And we know that at least seven Irish priests were silenced, and they still are. One of them died in the meantime. And over 107 international theologians were silenced as well, because they were continuing on what the Second Vatican Council, you know, trying to bring a doctrine up to date and trying to bring the church up to date, as we all are, as we are church. And that is our perspective. That is, we find the church now is becoming very irrelevant to young people. And we're saying is, you have to bring the church up to date. We can't be living back in, you know, in the Middle Ages and, you know, refusing women their rightful place and calling, you know, gay people something wrong with them. All of that language and all of that attitude has to change, because, and it will change eventually.
Do you think so?
But there is a lot of forces there, and he represented, you know, himself and John Paul, they represented this great power behind. They were saying things have got too far now. We have to put the boot down. Anyone who moves out of place, they'll be sanctioned. So that was the type we had for 32 years.
Indeed, I was speaking with Father Iggy O'Donovan yesterday about Pope Benedict's leadership of the Roman Catholic Church, and he'd have been critical for the same reasons about the attitude towards women in the church, same-sex couples and contraception. Very conservative Pope, but I think his biggest criticism was of how clerical child sexual abuse was handled or mishandled or covered up.
Yes, and when it broke out here in Ireland, he sent a special letter to the Irish Catholics, and he blamed, he said, well, it was due to the Irish bishops. Well, it certainly was. But he also blamed the Irish people for their lack of faith. And his attitude was always that there was nothing really wrong at the Vatican within the church. But yet, and he always claimed that it was sort of a something outside the church, and the sort of sexual revolution of the 1960s, he called it, as if that was causing all the clerical sex, you know, abuse. And it came out in 2001. He actually wrote a letter to all the bishops in the world in Latin, stating that any more communication of, if they have any credible accusation against any priest, they must send it directly to him in Rome. So he was inundated from 1981. He would have known everything that was happening throughout the Catholic world. And it was a tsunami at that stage. And I think that was a part. He couldn't cope with that. Because then he had to realize that it was a structural problem in the Catholic Church, and that radical reform was necessary. And I think at that stage, by, you know, his resignation, he just couldn't cope with it.
Okay, but it's true to say he inherited most of these problems, didn't he? And not much has changed since he resigned.
No. We see in Black Rock College, at the moment in Poland, there's a big controversy about that when John Paul was Archbishop of Krakow, that there were four priests who were abusing, and he didn't do anything about it. So now, in every country, in Germany, every country, you know, if you examine, you'll find clerical sex abuse. And it has to do with the Catholic Church. And something has to be done, and radically done. No bishop has ever been sanctioned. They sanction priests, all right. And if a priest speaks out of turn, he's silenced. But when a priest is involved in clerical sex abuse, you know, he just is, you know, told stop it and move on. But so that's the problem.
It's always been very hard
about sexuality. You know, when it comes to sex, we have a problem.
It's always been very hard for people to balance that in their minds, I think, Brendan, because I think people would look on sexual abuse, particularly child sexual abuse, as something that is intrinsically evil, if I can use that turn of phrase. But for a Christian preacher to carry out such a dreadful act is beyond comprehension, and for a blind eye approach to be taken to it is all the utter.
And as you say, it still persists right through. I know Pope Francis tries to do something. But at the same time, there should be a radical shift, you know, that any priest, any bishop, they should be sanctioned immediately and they should be removed from the church. And so and also the training of seminarians, they're put into these colleges, all male. And it encourages... I think it attracts that type of person, and then it reinforces that type of behaviour among men. And so we need to change the whole
way. Well, they had to close Maynooth about 10 years ago, didn't they? It was about 10 years ago, I think, they had to close Maynooth because of orgies, basically, men jumping into bed with other men on a continuous basis.
Yes, yeah, and so that's why we need women in the church, you know.
But you said earlier on you think that's going to change. What makes you feel that? I mean, I think I was speaking to you 10 years or 15 years ago and you were saying that, and I don't see any prospect of it yet.
No, and I think the great anathema in the Catholic Church, and that was John Paul II too, he almost made it a dogma of the Catholic Church that no woman can ever be involved in the ministry of the church. You can, you know, you can bring in the flowers, you can scrub the floors, you can clean the pews, but you're never going to be on that altar. But that has to change. And we are, as Catholics, progressive Catholics, we do believe that. Because at one stage, the church said, oh, you know, you can take money and get any amount of usury on it. And all of that slavery, they backed slavery, all of that, that eventually changed. But it took years and years and years of people fighting, though, not literally fighting, but struggling with authority to try and convince these people. Because when you see young people, they're walking away from this church. Yeah. By the droves, women are walking away. And it's so obvious to us. And we say there'll be no church in the future. There'll be a future of a few people there, and they'll be very white.
I don't know, Brendan. I mean, when you say you think it's going to happen, I mean, do you believe that either of us would ever see women priests in our lifetime?
No. But there's a big movement in America, and there's about 500 women. They found a bishop here in Austria about 20 years ago who was willing to ordain women. And a group of American women went over to this bishop. Now it was illegal, but still the bishop had that power. And he ordained them, and they're over in America. And there's one Irish woman.
But they're not valid ordinations, are they? I mean, you know, if that's happened, and I'm sure it has, I imagine the bishop was excommunicated, and the ordinations aren't deemed to be valid.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a different thing, I suppose, but... listen, we'll leave it there for the moment. Pope Benedict will be buried tomorrow, obviously, and people will be remembering him over the coming days. And thank you indeed for sharing your thoughts with us.
For good and for bad.
And yes, indeed. Thank you, Brendan Butler, member of We Are Church Ireland.
Michael Reed on LMFM.
Thanks to the Navin listener contacting us, saying it was great to see the love and respect that has been given all over the world for Pele. He did nothing but good for the world and showed nothing but good example, especially to young people in a world of cover-up and corruption. Thank God for people like Pele. Lord rest them. Thank you indeed, Navin listener, for that. Thanks to Betty, who's been in touch about the overcrowding situation in hospital. A couple of people in touch with us about that today, saying you wouldn't treat an animal like that. You'd expect there to be better conditions if you were going to the vets than one of our hospitals. Somebody else in touch saying my mother was in hospital since Friday last and there wasn't a pillow for her until Sunday. That was in the Lourdes Hospital. Thank you indeed to those of you who've been in touch. If you'd like to make comment on the programme today, tell us about your own hospital experience or something else for that matter. Our telephone number is 041 983 2000. You can text or WhatsApp 086 1800 658, email michael@lmfm.ie for that matter. Now let's stay with that hospital situation and the ongoing overcrowding in hospitals right across the country, and we'll hear more from the Minister for Health, Stephen Donnelly, now.
So would I like to see more staff, more beds, more nursing home beds, more diagnostics? I would. Government has allocated the funding. We've sanctioned it through the national service plans, and whilst the HSE hasn't hit all of the targets, I think we really do need to reflect that the HSC over the last 2.5 years or 3 years, while dealing with COVID, has added more beds, more staff, more diagnostics than any previous year. And would we all like to see more? Of course we would. And the second thing that needs to happen is we need to make sure that patient flow is as good as it can be all over the country. And we see some parts of the country are doing very, very well. Other parts or other hospitals are struggling more. And one of the things I'm working with the HSC on is to make sure that that the best possible approaches in the interest of the patients are used right across the system. There's also things I think will help, like the new consultant contract. The figures today, for example, show Letterkenny. A lot of people waiting on trolleys in Letterkenny. Now, there's a new nursing home going to be built right across from the hospital, which will help in terms of discharge, particularly short-stay discharge. But Letterkenny has struggled to hire consultants. And I was up there recently. I was talking with them about various teams they have where they might have sanctioned for 6 consultants, but they can only hire 1 or 2. My hope is that the new consultant contract will make a difference. I hope the IMO and the IHCA will back it. I hope they will endorse it. And the message can go out from Ireland right around the world to so many of our Irish-trained consultants to say, come home, we've got a great new contract. We are fundamentally building and reforming our public health service, and come home and help us with that work.
Well, very good. That's Minister for Health Stephen Donnelly speaking to reporters. Great to think that we've got a great new contract for consultants, come home and work in our health service and solve this problem. But as we start this new year, we have once again the same old problems. It's a new year with a new minister in terms of how long this problem has been going on. And it is the same old problem that we've been facing into every January with the same old problems and the same situation of it being overcrowded and so on. Same solutions are being offered, and once again we have a government minister telling us how it's going to be solved. But the question is, will we be in the same situation come next year? It's a situation that has worsened over the years, and as we've been hearing, it was declared a national emergency in 2006 when there were less than 500 people on trolleys. Yesterday there were close to 1,000 people on trolleys.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
Now, we'll stay with pressure on hospitals, but from a slightly different perspective, because we're told that there's only a handful of adolescent inpatient mental health beds in the country, and that this has led to a hidden epidemic. It's a crisis that is being highlighted by two consultant psychiatrists, Dr. Mary Cannon and Dr. Michelle Hill, who say that there's been an astronomical number of self-harm presentations, and that the number of young people who are self-harming is shocking. Let's speak to Fiona Jennings, who's Senior Policy and Public Affairs Manager with the ISPCC. A very good morning to you, Fiona. Thank you indeed for joining us on the programme this morning. It's relatively commonplace, isn't it, that young people are finding life difficult and coming to harm themselves in some way. Is this a new phenomenon?
Good morning, Michael. Look, it was very concerning to read what Dr. Mary Cannon and Dr. Michelle Hill, her colleague as well, were reporting in terms of what they're seeing of children and young people presenting, as you said there, to A&E with self-harm and suicidal ideation. Is it a new phenomenon? We certainly hear about it in Childline from time to time. And I suppose with us, it's the that mental, emotional health profile, if you want, has been consistently in the top two of the reasons that children and young people call us and get in touch with us. So when we talk about that, then, what they're telling us then is that, there's huge issues around anxiety and stress. Bereavement can be an issue. Depression, loneliness, low moods, unhappiness. So there's a lot of things, I suppose, that kind of can come together there. But I suppose what then kind of leads children on to, self-harm, etc. And I know Dr. Mary Cannon would have said that, self-harm sometimes is that cry for help. So is it a stage? Is it at, you know, where children and young people get to a certain point, they just can't cope no longer. And that they see that that's their kind of cry for help. It's hugely concerning. As I said, we know that children are struggling to cope, even with the you know, day-to-day things, the normal adversities in life, if you want.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, though, is it an option that children perceive is available to them that previous generations wouldn't have seen to have been an option? There's always been things like anxiety, stress, loneliness, depression, bullying, and so on that children have faced into. But is there an increase in children who are acting on those feelings and self-harming as a result?
I think there probably is, like anecdotally wise, I think that, you know, from what we would see is that children perhaps would see it as an option, shall we say, for coping. They are probably more exposed to it in terms of what they're seeing on social media and how it's portrayed there. So the impact social media can have as well. You know, obviously, like so many children now, they have their own smartphone. You know, they have access to devices that are internet enabled, and they're basically able to watch whatever they want, consume, you know, that type of media, whichever way they want. Sometimes with little, I suppose, oversight, if you want.
And being directed to it by all accounts, according to that Facebook whistleblower who talked about the algorithms and that young people would be directed through links to harmful sites.
Yes, well, we know from, I suppose, the Molly Russell case in the UK, where the coroner's report there, and they were categorical in terms of what they put into their report, that, you know, it was absolutely a contributing factor to the death of Molly Russell in terms of the content that she was being served up. So sometimes people go online, they may be looking for help and support, you know, for managing their low mood or their...
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
They're negative feelings, and, you know, they're served up this particular type of content, which is harmful. And I suppose to somebody who, where there's already a vulnerability there, it can absolutely exacerbate it. It is concerning that, you know, that the only place these children feel they can go and the only place they do have to go is to A&E. And we know from all the coverage in the media at the moment, the huge pressure that's already on the emergency departments, you know, in terms of like the seasonal flu, etc. And then for a child or young person to be in that mix as well, you know, if they have a mental health issue and they need support, or they have suicidal behaviour as well.
Yeah, I know that some young people or their parents, for that matter, have been told to go to A&D because it's the only way that they'll get a referral. Otherwise, they'll be left lingering forever. And it seems as though there's a crisis when it comes to crisis situations. We don't have the infrastructure in place. We don't have the beds in place. We don't have the staffing in place. We don't have the system up and running to deal with people who are in a crisis situation. But it begins before that, doesn't it? Because we also have a problem in early intervention.
Oh, yeah, very much so. And I mean, what we're talking about here, what Dr. Cannon and Dr. Hill are talking about, is very much the end point, if you want. But exactly as you said, Michael, so much more can happen along the way. Yes, we're always going to need inpatient beds for, you know, children and young people who have, I suppose, severe mental health difficulties. But there's so much work that can be done up to that point. Now, I know they do bring up the thing around, you know, there's never been as much awareness around, you know, well-being and that type of education, if you want. But, you know, the rates are still not dropping. So we wonder, you know, is it that more and more children are just becoming aware of how they're feeling and can't cope? Or is it that, you know, the well-being that education that's out there is not meeting their needs today? So I think there's a lot more that we need to understand behind those issues as well. Even for ourselves in Childline, you know, we often try to delve in behind the statistics, so behind that mental emotional health profile, to better understand what exactly is happening, what are the stories behind those children, and then look at, you know, what the policy responses need to be.
And maybe you could expand on that, Fiona. Are you talking about children who maybe have mental health problems naturally, or that there's triggers in their life, or a combination of both?
A combination of both. I mean, even for, you know, adult mental health, there will always be a small proportion of the population where, you know, mental illness is prevalent, and they will need the required help and support. And I suppose what the concerns are is the prevention and the early intervention work that we're all trying to do. You know, if there was better investment there, so even more increased but targeted investment as well along the way. And we often talk about, you know, universal programs and trying to teach children to cope better, to recognise their feelings, to recognise how they react to their feelings as well. Yeah. So to kind of have that embedded along the way to help them, I suppose, develop better long-term coping skills as well, right through into teenage years, into adulthood as well. So, and I suppose with parents as well, that, you know, parents, they know their children best. Yeah. And for the support that parents can be offered as well, in terms of, you know, recognising even the smallest changes in behaviour in their child or young person as well. And to have conversations with them, you know, around those changes in behaviour, and also as well to have conversations with them around, you know, what they're, you know, how they're consuming, I suppose, digital media as well, social media. Because there is, you know, with children out there, that it's really important to talk to them about what they're seeing online, that it's not reality. Yeah. And sometimes they can be aspiring to that.
And I mean, that's the best early intervention possible, because it's from the most trusted source possible. Children, generally speaking, trust their parents above everybody else. And, you know, I have to say, from the stories you hear about services, you really would have to sympathise with parents if they are in a situation where their child is in a crisis, because the services just aren't there. They're woeful by all accounts. What would you say to somebody who is a parent? As you say, they know their children better than anybody else, but if they wake up one day feeling that their child is a stranger all of a sudden, or their behaviour has been such that it's alien to what they know of their child, and that they're worried about them, and what should they be doing at that stage?
Yeah, I mean, look, if there is a parent listening to this and they're in that situation, the first thing is, you know, don't panic. You're not alone. You know, there are organisations out there that can help. I mean, GPs can be a fantastic first port of call in terms of signposting, you know, parents to different organisations. Even like ourselves in ISPCC, you know, we have a support line available Monday to Friday, where, you know, parents themselves can ring up if they've got a concern or a query. And our trained personnel are able to talk them through different options that might be there. Sometimes the parents themselves need somebody to listen to them in order to give them the confidence, or for them, for the parents themselves to recognise, you know, they already have the skills there to talk to their child or young person, and to really kind of, you know, talk to somebody themselves first, and then, you know, broach it with their child or young person as well to try to figure out, you know, what's happened, you know, what's changed, that they've noticed there's been a change in their behaviour. You know, has something happened to them? Have they seen something that's upset them? Has somebody said something? And to broach it in that way, first of all, you know, sometimes it might be that the child or young person just needs somebody to actually, you know, meaningfully sit down and talk with them. Mm. And then it's in those types of situations, you know, that children can reveal what's going on. They may have been struggling with something, that, you know, bullying might be happening, or there might be something more, I suppose, more severe going on as well. But try to kind of pick up on the small cues as you go along as well. And sometimes that's easier said than done. Yeah, you know, yeah, we all live very busy lives today as well. But it's about kind of having that network around them as well. You know, talking to the teachers in school, talking to coaches as well, just to see, kind of building up that picture to see, are those behaviours, you know, different in the classroom setting as well, or different on the sports field, or is it just at home, to try and get a picture as to what's going on.
Yeah. To let our children know that they're valued, that they're loved, and that their life is very, very important.
Absolutely.
All right, Fiona. Thank you indeed for joining us on the programme today. That's Fiona Jennings, Senior Policy and Public Affairs Manager with the ISPCC. Now, thanks to Sean, who's been in touch with us, who said maybe we should all get on a plane and head off to Angola to get hospital treatment. He says Mary Harney was correct. We're now worse than Angola. What's the point of spending money educating doctors and then they leave as soon as they've qualified? Once they have their degree, they're gone, says Sean. Thank you indeed, Sean. Actually, I'm not sure, I think it was Brian Cowan when he was appointed Minister for Health. He said it's like the Ministry for Angola. But it was one of them. Anyway, Joe, thanks you for your message too. He says, Michael, whatever you think of Pope Benedict or any other pope, or indeed modern day standards, the Ten Commandments still stand. The world may change, but the Lord remains the same. The problem today is a lot of people don't want to listen to a message that will only bring joy to them. Thank you indeed, Joe, for your text at the programme today.
Michael Reed on LMFM.
Now, over the next 7 years, the world we live in today will be unrecognisable because of the necessary move to reduce carbon emissions under the Climate Action Plan that was published just before Christmas, and the way we live our lives as a result. Indeed, you could say it's not a question of if it will be an unrecognisable world, but it'll have to be an unrecognisable world because the emissions must be reduced, and that's by law.
It's important to understand where this sits, and it sits in our legal structures, in the law, with real import. This is not an ordinary report which is advisory or which is descriptive. It is the legal basis in which we will carry out the transition, the change we need to make. The change is beyond compare. In electricity, we're an area where we have comparative competitive advantage and every reason to make the leap, because of the high price of fossil fuels and the security threat we're under because of the war in Ukraine, we will switch massively to renewables. Continued onshore wind, offshore wind, solar, a whole range of different renewable supplies where we can and will deliver the clean power that will give our country security into the future.
Green Party leader and Minister for the Environment, Eamon Ryan, and there will be a 75% reduction in emissions through electricity. For commercial and public buildings, emissions will reduce by 45%, 40% for residential buildings. Transport is said to see a 50% cut, a 35% cut in industry, and 25% in agriculture. Pauline O'Reilly, Green Party Senator, is chair of the Green Party and a member of the Oireachtas Environment and Climate Committee, and joins us now. And a very good morning to you, Senator O'Reilly. Thank you indeed for joining us on the programme this morning. What happens under the law if these targets are not met?
Well, they will. Well, they'll have to be met. So there will be probably sanctions against departments who don't meet the targets. But they'll be adjusted every year. So this is one of a number of climate action plans. And so every year the targets would get tougher if a department is failing to meet that. But it isn't just in relation to departments themselves, but it's also in relation to the regulator for electricity, in relation to local authorities, so that they all have obligations. And the first obligation for local authorities is to have a climate action plan. Previously, they had had plans which were really just about adapting their own services, where these plans will have to be in relation to everything in a county or in a particular area, town or city. Things are going to ramp up now from this year, because this is the first plan that is a legally binding one.
Okay. When you say sanctions against the departments, what form might they take?
Well, realistically, what they'll be is that you'll have greater and greater ambition to reach, and you know, as with any job, if people aren't performing to expectations, there'll probably be things, you know, people shuffled around. But I think it's too early to say that right now, other than that it is legally binding, and so they have an obligation to meet it.
Okay. Is it possible to fulfil a legal obligation if the task you're charged with is impossible?
Well, I don't believe that it is impossible. And one of the good things about this is we've spent a significant amount of time on the Climate Act, which is the law that underpins it, and strengthened an advisory climate change advisory board. And it's that board that has recommended a lot of the changes and has looked at what is realistic, but actually what is absolutely necessary. And it is going to mean that people's lives are changed. But I think that it's important that we remember that it is also for the better, because it's changing habits that have got us to this stage. And also it's changing the future for our children. And not just future generations, but actually the generations who are alive now. Mm. And so things in the plan are like reducing down car mileage by 20%, for instance.
How?
One of the ways is obviously through increased public transport and cycling. But one of the other ways, of course, is that people would need to have less journeys. And so some of the measures that we put in place around flexible working, which is something that Minister Roderick O'Gorman has a recent piece of legislation on, those are things that also mean that people need to travel less. Now, obviously, one size doesn't fit all for every family. Mm. But, you know, one of the things that we found going into government was that only 53% of the population were served by public transport. And so we set an ambition there and money behind that to increase that to 70%, so that 70% of people would have a good local option for transport across rural Ireland.
Can that be done in the time frame?
Well, we've already seen a rollout of new bus services, and that's phase one. I mean, there's a new bus service, for instance, going from Navan to Drogheda. Mm. And so there are links not just up with the capital city, which is what it used to be, but there are links with towns across Ireland. And, you know, indeed, I'm from the west of Ireland, so we've seen a number of new bus services there as well, because that was particularly poorly served. So that's what needs to happen. We have 91 new carriages coming on stream for trains, and hope to get new train lines opened on our old rail lines, which should never have been shut down, in my opinion. But local authorities are going to have to step up, and local councillors are also going to have to step up to the mark when it comes to cycle lanes, because we do need to ensure that we get cycle lanes. That means in some instances that some parking spaces will have to be removed, and that's not an easy...
Well, something will have to be done, because a lot of these roads are designed for horse and carts, aren't they?
Well, some certainly in our towns are narrow, but they're also at the moment having lots of parking on either side in many instances, not everywhere, as I say, but in some instances. And it does mean re-looking at how do we use our roads. It had to be looked at several decades ago, and now we have to re-look at it again. And
but given the infrastructure and the way roads are designed, are you talking about more one-way streets so that the road could be shared between cars and bicycles and e-scooters and so on?
In some instances, it's one-way. And in some instances, it is removing parking from one side of the road. It's not one size fits all, as I say. But what we really need to do is make sure, particularly that children can safely cycle, and older vulnerable adults, but all of us, in fact, because I think a lot of us feel that it's unsafe unless we have that infrastructure. So that's really important. And what we see actually is that about 30% of the traffic is kids being brought to school. So I have been pushing for a ramping up of school bus services, for instance, so that it's not just cycling, but that there are options there for people and that parents aren't stuck in their cars because they don't feel that there's another option for them.
Okay.
So those things are going to change. We'll have solar panels on every school building by 2025. So I think that people will see the change and will feel that it is better, but it isn't without a significant rethinking and reframing of our own consciousnesses in what we expect from daily life.
All right. But does it mean that if you get the train instead of driving to work, if you're going some distance, that you'll have to stand for the length of the journey? I got on a train the other day, and if anybody else had turned up for that train, they'd have been left on the platform because there really wasn't enough room on the train. It was very uncomfortable given all of the viral diseases that are around at the moment. I know that there's always a problem with the airport bus, for example. It's a half an hour late every single day of the year.
Well, look, in relation to the airport bus, I wasn't aware of that, but I'll certainly look into that. But what I will say about carriages is, as I said earlier, we have new delivery now of carriages, and that's going to be ongoing. But it is a symptom of the fact that more and more people are taking the train, which in some ways is good, but we have to make sure that all of the infrastructure is there. And as I say, there's delivery of 91 new carriages. And many were moving to electric as well. But the reduction that Minister Ryan put in place, which was 20% reduction on all public transport and 50% for people under the age of 24, we're continuing that. And people are using more public transport as a result. So we are seeing return from that, and also from the free school transport, which again we introduced to save people money, but it also has an impact then on the environment. And so I really want to see the Minister for Education next year and the year after really ramping up on the school buses.
The biggest offender, most emissions from agriculture and they've least to do, it seems, in terms of reducing emissions. Was that a case of the farmers winning the argument?
Well, we always said that it was going to be a challenge in farming, and it's not just about farmers; it's actually about food production as well, which serves us all. So we're all reliant on our food sector, agriculture and transport are pretty much close to each other, on a par when it comes to emissions. And transport, we do need to see a 50% reduction. That's what we've set as a target. And in agriculture, we've set 25% as a target. But already in agriculture, we are seeing huge changes. There's more and more people turning to organic farming, for instance, and that is because of the increased finance and grants behind organic farming that we've put in place. And we have a target of 10% by 2030, which is a huge leap for Ireland. We also have a really ambitious forestry target, 1.3 billion euro going into it. And we have new schemes, which are agri-environmental schemes. And certainly farmers that I have met are happy with the with that new scheme, that ACRES scheme, which will promote biodiversity, but also then promotes a different mix of farming. And we have a target for tillage farming, which is going to, you know, massively increase tillage.
And do you believe that will reduce the national herd because people will be incentivized to diversify and go into organic or forestry or whatever the case may be?
Exactly. Well, I mean, it's important to realise that organic farming includes animals in that as well, but it certainly is a less intensive form of farming, and we would see that all of these measures would naturally reduce the size of the herd, absolutely. But ensuring that farmers have an income and that's maintained and that they are paid for the work that they do for the environment is important. And, you know, anaerobic digestion is another one where farmers will be paid for anaerobic digestion, and that's using the waste on their farms. And so if farmers feel that they're supported, and, you know, there's probably it's less intensive and less, less challenging work in some respects. That's what I've certainly heard from organic farmers, because you're putting, you know, you're not putting fertilizers to the same extent on the land. You have less money that you're putting into it, but you're getting higher higher payments then at the end of it, and that's what we want to see happen, because 60% of our land is private, and so it's farmers that really are the custodians of the environment in any respect.
There's huge challenges ahead, as you say, they're legally binding, so they'll have to happen over the course of the next 7 years or so. But we leave it there for the moment, and that's obviously the first of many steps for that matter. But thank you indeed for joining us on the programme this morning. That's Senator Pauline O'Reilly, who's the chair of the Green Party and a member of the Oireachtas Environment and Climate Committee.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
If you're living in County Louth and you bought your house sometime between October and December, you paid 9% more than you would have in the final 3 months of 2021, 5% more in County Meath if you bought during that time period compared to a year previously. And in County Louth now, the average price of a home is €271,000. In County Meath, it's €319,000. That's according to the latest report from daft.ie. The author of the report is Ronan Lyons, and Ronan Lyons is an economist at Trinity College in Dublin. He's on the line with us. A very good morning to you, Ronan. Thanks as always for joining us on the programme this morning. We're seeing more increases, but you're seeing some hope on the horizon, are you?
Yeah, so you went through some of the key numbers there. If we take a step back and look at the country as a whole, the increase in over the course of 2022 was about 6%. Now, on the face of it, that doesn't sound like a big change from the previous 2 years, when the increases were about 8%. But when you look at what was happening sort of between the year-end reviews, you can actually see a pattern where there was quite a lot of uncertainty at different points during COVID. But overall, COVID boosted demand and worsened supply. It boosted demand because people were at home and they had less discretionary spending. Their savings went up by more than they expected, and that typically translated through into higher house prices, especially outside of the major cities. And it weakened supply. COVID weakened supply because you couldn't go and view properties. That actually meant that the second-hand market in particular seized up quite a bit. Now, over the course of 2022, both of those things started to change. Supply improved, more homes started coming onto the market, but also demand weakened. Demand weakened because the macroeconomy has changed. People are talking about inflation and the cost of living crisis. Everyone's a little bit less certain about how things are going to look 2 or 3 years from now. And as a result, with demand weakening and supply improving, I think the mood music as of January 2023 is quite different to when we were having this discussion, say, a year ago.
Right. And what about mortgage interest rates?
I mean, that's the most obvious way in which somebody looking to buy a home can see how conditions have changed. Just personally speaking, myself, my wife, we were coming off a fixed rate mortgage, and we were looking to get a rate a year ago. The rate that we got a year ago has doubled since. from roughly 2% to roughly 4%. And that's not atypical. That's relatively common across the market, that fixed interest rates have changed quite a bit over the last 12 months. That is going to feed through into weaker demand over the course of 2023. We're a little bit behind the curve compared to a lot of European countries. A lot of European countries saw the interest rate increases happening June, September, November last year. In Ireland, we're a little bit behind the curve. As late as October, November, interest rates in general hadn't moved that much. They have increased quite a bit since then, and bringing us into line. And that will, you can look at, if you look at the sentiment, one of the elements of the report is a survey of how people feel about the market. And you can see in that people don't expect prices to increase in the year ahead, in part because of things like higher interest rates. And that itself, even if the expectation is wrong, if people expect conditions to be a bit calmer, they're less likely to rush their own decision.
Yeah, it becomes all the more unaffordable if you have to pay out more each month on your repayments. But that in itself won't bring down prices, because there's a lot of pressure on every sector, isn't there, because of the cost of living, and construction is certainly one of those sectors that has felt the brunt of it, and it's getting more expensive to build.
Yeah, I think in some ways you've got to look at the housing market in two parts. There's the second-hand market, where what it cost to build your home whenever it was built 10, 30, 50 years ago is irrelevant, but it's about what it's worth on the market now. And I think that's where there's a lot more flexibility up and down. Whereas new-build homes, it's really about the cost of the materials and the land, of course, that go into it. And as you mentioned, the cost of materials has increased by relatively unprecedented percentages over the last year and a half to 2 years. COVID had, and if people might remember, the ship that was stuck in the Suez Canal, the Evergreen.
Oh, yeah.
That was kind of like the picture that people have in their heads of the start of this, what is known as supply chain disruptions. But starting from there and going through to the war in Ukraine, that has had an impact of about 20% on construction costs. And what that means is that building the same home, in order to break even, the developers will have to charge a significantly higher price. And in that sense, they're combined with higher interest rates, they're looking at a smaller share of the market. Who can afford, with higher interest rates, the higher construction cost? It's going to be a smaller share of the market. The one thing pushing in the other direction is our policy measures. On the one hand, the central bank has relaxed its mortgage rules. So now you can borrow up to 4 times your income rather than 3.5. And if you're a second-time buyer, you only need a 10% deposit rather than a larger deposit. So that's on the one hand, that will make things a little bit easier for people to borrow. And on the other hand, the government has introduced a shared equity scheme where, say, round numbers, you might have a deposit of 10%. The government might invest 10%, and then you borrow the other 80%. Unlike Help to Buy, where it's effectively a gift, shared equity, the government retains its 10%, and you can buy it out, but it's not money that the government just gives away. It's an investment that the government will get back at some point. Both of those things will help demand a little bit, but I think overall, the conditions in the market, as you described, with higher interest rates and higher construction costs, all of that is going to feed through into a weaker market in 2023 compared to 2022.
Right, that's in-house sales. If that's the case, and if it's true to say that supply has increased but hasn't increased in line with demand, what impact is that going to have overall? Does it mean that there will be further increases in the cost of renting?
Yeah, as you say, we've been talking about the sales market. The sales market, for all of its woes, it is in better health now than it was 5 or 6 years ago, when there were very few transactions taking place. There were very few new homes getting built. It is in a better place now than it was. On the rental side, there has been no improvement, really. We have been losing our rental stock, in part into the sales segment. We have not been replacing it, especially outside Dublin. And even what is being built in Dublin in terms of new rental accommodation is very small relative to the scale of the need. So overall, the picture on the rental market is It's definitely the case, I think, that 2023 will be another year of scarcity. So it will really come down to how much more people can afford to pay in rent to secure somewhere, given that availability is very tight. If you can do the charts for supply, for how many homes are available to buy or to rent at any particular point in time, that's improving on the sales side, and it's coming back to where it was pre-COVID. In the rental side, it's at all-time lows. It's at lows. In the case of Dublin, we can go back over 20 years, and we have seen nothing like the very low level of homes available to rent at any particular point in time. So unfortunately, on the rental side, I don't think we'll see any improvement in conditions this year.
All right, which is peculiar for a lot of people who are renting who wish they had a mortgage instead of paying out so much, as is the case in rent, because it would be cheaper in terms of the monthly repayments for a lot of people, it would seem. But just to get to the bottom line then, if this trend that you're seeing now continues, Ronan, will it result in a fall in prices?
I wouldn't be surprised if we saw prices certainly stabilising and perhaps falling in certain markets over the course of the next few months. I think it will depend on where. There are some markets where supply is still very low, and with COVID having reshuffled housing demand a bit, it may still be the case that there's good value for people who, especially if interest rates are going up, people are looking for cheaper markets, and they may be prepared to look at regions they wouldn't have before. So I think there may still be increases in some markets, but overall, I think for the country as a whole, and certainly for the more expensive markets in the country, I'd be very surprised if we saw increases like we have been used to seeing over the last couple of years of 3-4% in the first couple of months of the year. I'd be very surprised if we saw that this year. I'd be less surprised if we saw falls of a couple of percent in the first few months of the year.
Okay, all right, very interesting. Thank you indeed, as always, for joining us this morning. That's Ronan Lyons, an economist at Trinity College in Dublin, who is the author of that report for daft.ie.
Michael Reed on LMFM.
Now we're going to speak once again to Kevin Comiskey, who's chairman of the IFA Sheep Committee and a regular guest on this programme for the same reason in different parts of the country, time and again. And a very good morning to you, Kevin, and thank you indeed for joining us on the programme this morning. We're talking about a significant amount of sheep that were killed in Tipperary going into the new year.
Indeed. Good morning, Michael, and Happy New Year to you and your listeners.
Yes.
And unfortunately, it's not a Happy New Year in this instance. And indeed, as you said, only a couple of weeks as I spoke to you before on the same issue, another horrendous attack down there yesterday in Lara or during the week there. Terrible atrocities again. Out see that slaughter for the sheep involved, and then for the family. Horrific on the family going down, and neighbours went out, and hear the lady describing it yesterday as one of the neighbours going out and crying actually in the field. The trauma on the sheep and the trauma on the families, it's just horrific. It's beyond explanation.
Mm-hmm. 45 sheep killed outright, 20 others had to be put down, and I'm quoting this, because most had their eyes and faces ripped away. Another 5 are missing. Overall, it's 70 dead, 20 injured and 5 sheep missing. It's just beyond belief.
It's a huge significant kill, and I suppose had to be a few dogs involved or whatever, you know, along with the financial loss, the trauma, as I said, there's huge financial loss there in going out. There's huge financial loss in gathering up them sheep and getting them away. They have to be all taken away and disposed of, and there's huge cost involved in that. And the trauma, as I said, going out and collecting them, getting them scattered around the field dead. And I just can't bear to think what it's like. Like, I did visit the one in Moneygall, and I didn't get to visit this one, but you can only imagine what it's like going around finding dead animals around the field in numerous numbers like that. It's horrific.
Mm. Yeah, the farmer, Donal O'Donoghue, told the Journal, these were killer dogs. They went for the hoggets' faces and throats, and in a few instances, they ripped their stomachs wide open. This is horror movie stuff. But the point of it is not to upset people listening to us this morning. We're all upset listening to it, but we were upset the last time, as you said, Kevin, and the time before. And unless there is some real action, we're going to be upset again about this.
Yes, yes, indeed. And unfortunately, I suppose, as I said in a few interviews there, it's the big numbers and huge, significant numbers that gets highlighted. But I'm getting calls, and I've said this numerous occasions, weekly, daily basis, you know, there could be two here, there could be seven somewhere else, there could be up to 15, you know, smaller numbers going under the radar. But I said this when I was first elected last year on the 28th and 27th of January. I said it was a priority of mine to work on this, because I'd been 6 years on the committee and every time it was on the agenda. And I said, this is one thing, if I can do anything, it's one thing. There's loads of issues with the sheep sector. But I said this was a priority because this slaughter has to stop. And I did go, like, the 27th of January, the morning that I was elected onto the as chairman, Minister McConnell and Minister Humphreys stood in a field out in County Dublin. And they were highlighting this issue of dog control and how dangerous it can be at any time of the year, but especially around the lambing time, they were saying. And still, we went to them, IFA committee, myself and our committee went to them. We had concrete proposals. They know exactly what we want and what's needed. It may not be perfect, but it's significant what we want. We want the microchipping, the microchips, the licensing linked to the responsible owner, a single national database, and the penalties put in place, proper sanctions and penalties put in place that will reflect this horrendous damage that's been witnessed right across the country. And, like, there's three departments there involved, and in fairness, the Minister McConnellogue did write to the other two ministers and said that he wanted to meet them and get this sorted out. And 3 weeks ago yesterday, I travelled from Moneygall back to Dublin, and it was a motion of no confidence, and we waited and we met with the minister. In fairness, he gave us a good listening to, and it was late, 12 o'clock that night nearly when we left him, and he said he would act in January. And that's why I'm calling out this morning, and I've done it yesterday on different media outlets, and I've been in contact with Minister Humphreys, and my colleague Vice Chairman has been in contact with Minister McConnellogue to get an emergency meeting called out between the three ministers, get the three ministers around the table, and one minister take ownership, probably Mr. McConnellogue preferably, take ownership of this and just get it sorted out, because all them sanctions and microchipping that I mentioned, enforcement, Michael, it'll be the key one. Mm. Because if you have all the laws in the world, if you have the enforcement on them, they fall at the first fence.
Yeah, and I suppose most dog owners are responsible. If everybody was as responsible as you'd hope they would be, then you wouldn't need any of these sanctions or the follow-through for that matter. What would you say to dog owners this morning, Kevin?
I'd plead with them, always make sure and know where your dog is at every stage of the time. If it's at night when you're going to bed, have a kennel, have the dog locked up, make sure the dog is under responsible control at all times. Even people out walking or anything, the dog has to be on a lead and has to be out. You know, the farm countryside is a beautiful place to be, but if you're out with your dog, you have to have them under effective control at all times, and you can't be letting them run willy-nilly away. And you'll see these posts up on Facebooks, you know, out on the hill, and next thing the dog has gone missing and that. That's totally irresponsible, and it's not acceptable, and it just cannot continue on to be going on like that. So, as you say, look, a majority of people is responsible, but there's over round rough figures, 900,000 dogs out there, maybe 190,000 microchipped or licensed. There's a whole vast amount of dogs there not in on the legislature or in on the microchip and a license, and they have to be brought in there, and the whole lot has to be pulled together.
Okay, we'll leave it there on that note, and hopefully it'll result in people taking on board what you had to say, Kevin. Thank you, though, for joining us this morning, and hopefully there'll be some action at a government level which will bring about a change, and that we don't have to talk about these terrible stories again in the future. Kevin Cummiskey, Chair of the IFA Sheep Committee. Maggie McGuire, research today. Chris Murray was in the control tower. I'm Michael, and God willing, we'll see you for our next programme tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. on LMFM. Good morning, bye-bye.
The Michael Reid Show podcast. Tune in weekdays from 9 on LMFM. To contact us, email now, michael@lmfm.ie.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.